I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 11th of March. Our guest this hour is a former Moscow correspondent for NPR who reported from Russia for almost a decade. He has a recent piece in Global Post in which he says Vladimir Putin doesn't really believe Russian claims that the West was behind the ousting of Ukraine's pro-Moscow leader Viktor Yanukovych last month, nor, as he sometimes argues, that Washington wants to overthrow the Kremlin and plunder Russia's natural resources. In fact, he's afraid of the example rebelling Ukrainians have set for Russians, especially of the danger that the development of rule of law and other Western attributes in Ukraine would erode the foundations of his governance at home. So this hour, we're going to be speaking with Gregory Pfeiffer. Gregory has an interesting background. His mother is Russian. He lived in Paris and New York, and he has written for numerous outlets, including the New Republic, the Washington Post, World Policy Journal. He witnessed the coup attempt against Mikhail Gorbachev in 1991, and on a fellowship from the Institute of Current World Affairs, examined the end of the Yeltsin era and Russia's subsequent transformation into an authoritarian state. He is the author of a book just released this month, actually, Russians, the People Behind the Power. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Gregory, and here is how you reach us all hour long, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hi, Gregory. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what was the real reason for this push into Crimea? Let's talk a little bit more about what I just outlined at the beginning of the show. He's worried about the West?
Well, you know, let me start by saying that Westerners and Americans included tend to find Russians mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
We can't understand why, for example, the Kremlin would threaten to direct nuclear missiles at Western Europe why, for example, Russia would want to essentially foment civil war in Ukraine, which is a very large country on Russia's southern border. It wouldn't seem on the face of it to be good for Russians. And my approach has been to look at Russians' behavior. During 8 years of my living and working in Russia, I've looked at their daily lives, their work patterns, family life, drinking. And what seems clear to me is that although Russian behavior seems chaotic to us, it's very successful in achieving its own aims. Now, these aren't Western aims. I think Russian motives and values are different than ours. And I think part of it is that Vladimir Putin makes decisions that are in his interest, not the country's. So acting like a tough guy abroad is good for his popularity at home. It shows him to be tough. I think his model of foreign policy is very much the Soviet one. He believes that to be respected in the world, you have to be feared and loathed. And I think that's essentially what he's trying to show, partly by invading Ukraine. And he's done this by sort of justified it by saying that there are sort of Ukrainian fascists who have kicked out Ukraine's pro-Russian leader, and that this is a Western-backed plot to essentially take control of Ukraine and try to influence events in Russia as well.
And if you were watching Russian television right now, is that what you would hear from Russian TV, that that's what was going on? It was a Western-based attempt?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a full-scale propaganda campaign going on, the likes of which we haven't seen. I saw some of that when I covered in 2008 Russia's invasion of Georgia. There were reports that there were Georgian spies crawling across Russia, setting up terrorist attacks, bomb attacks, none of which were true. And we're seeing exactly the same thing. According to Russian state television, this is an American-backed plot to control Ukraine and to try to essentially throw the Russian government out of power. I mean, the idea is, I mean, the, you know, Vladimir Putin has been talking about this for years, that the U.S. wants to undermine his rule, get rid of his government, and plunder Russia's natural resources, its vast oil and gas wealth. Now, we can understand often why he would do this. Americans essentially just want to get on with Russia. But I think the fact is that he, you know, this is a calculated effort to make him popular at home. Russians tend to be very nationalistic. There's a great nostalgia for the lost superpower status of the Cold War, and you know, this kind of thing is popular. There's a joke in Russia that Americans love their country and hate everybody who disagrees with them, and that Russians dislike their country and hate everybody who agrees with them. Hmm. I think that's a little harsh, but it gives you an idea of the dynamic.
Right. You also talk about the living standards and say in your recent piece, as long as living standards continue rising, thanks to the country's vast energy wealth, the Kremlin is free to be as authoritarian as it likes. As the West considers, and some are saying as early as Thursday, there could be sanctions placed against Russia, does that undermine his authority, his authoritarian rule? Is that a frightening prospect for Putin?
I think so. I think part of not only the his actions over Ukraine, his invasion of Crimea, but his general authoritarianism, which has really he's ramped up over the past couple of years since he's come back for a third term in 2012. He's waged a campaign against gays in Russia. He's jailed Pussy Riot. He's cracked down on the press and on NGOs in Russia. And I think part of this is driven by the fact that Russia's dominance in the energy market is wavering, or at least the predictions for the future are not so great. Energy prices, oil prices are fluctuating. There are new sources for natural gas all over the world, including in the United States. And Russia, which sells Europe about a third of the natural gas it uses, sees this as a threat.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that he would allow, the worst that could happen is you could, well, there are a lot of bad things that could happen, but to see Ukraine fall into a bloody, horrendous civil war. What's in it for Putin for that to happen?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. And as I was saying earlier, this is not in Russians' interest. This is not in the interest of his country. This is in Putin's interest because it makes them look tough. You know, for Russia, the best thing would be a prosperous, stable, independent Ukraine, which would be an ally and an important trading partner. And instead, we see time and time again that Russia tries to undermine essentially Ukraine's independence and Ukraine's inclination to join the European Union. Now, the crisis in Ukraine was prompted last fall when the pro-Moscow president Viktor Yanukovych rejected a major deal with the EU in favor of closer ties with Russia. Now, he was under tremendous pressure from Vladimir Putin. He wants Ukraine to join a so-called Eurasian Union, which would essentially resurrect to some degree the Soviet Union. I think the Soviet Union is partly a model for this. And the organization's prime goal, essentially, is to oppose Western organizations like the EU and NATO. And for Putin, having Ukraine turn its back on Russia and join the West is less preferable than the country erupting into civil war. He would rather see it split apart than see it join the West.
Can you give us a better understanding, Gregory, of who is really calling the shots? Is it the decisions that he makes, and he gets Parliament to just rubber stamp his decisions? Who's got the authority?
I think, to a large degree, yes. It's very much Putin. He's very strong, and he has been able to essentially make Parliament into a rubber stamp organization that backs his legislation. Russia's leading businessmen are essentially in his pocket. The corrupt court system is politically controlled, essentially top down from the Kremlin. And you were saying a little earlier about this social contract. That's the conventional wisdom, that essentially Putin has been able to get away with all of this because he has essentially made this social contract that as long as living standards continue to rise, thanks to income from Russia's vast energy resources, the Kremlin is more or less free to do what it likes. I actually don't believe that's the case. I think that the real glue binding Putin's regime to the population is corruption.
Mm. And you write about that in your piece, that corruption is pretty rampant.
It's all pervasive. You know, in a sense, it is the system. And I think this is one of the things that Westerners don't understand about Russia. You know, we look at corruption as a problem that's present all over the world. There's certainly tons of corruption in the United States. But Americans live more or less according to the rule of law, as do most Europeans. In Russia, that's not the case. So, look, take, for example, the Sochi Olympic Games, which gained so much press for Russia, I think rightly. These were the most expensive games ever, $50 billion. We know that $7 billion in contracts during the preparations for the game went to companies connected to one man alone, who happened to be Putin's former childhood friend and judo partner.
Oh.
Now, this gives you the, you know, and $7 billion, that's
a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. That's about the same amount that the entire Vancouver 2010 Olympic Games cost. So that gives you a sense of, you know, of the kind of corruption that's going on. But it's not only at the top. It's everyone. If you're a driver, you know that you will be stopped by the traffic police. That's a certainty. And to get out of it, you will have to pay a bribe. If you own a corner store, for example, you'll have to pay the building inspector, the health safety inspector, the fire safety inspector. And this enables essentially the authorities to coerce the population because they can pretty much prosecute almost anybody. But it also gives people a stake in the system. It co-opts them because if you're the corner store owner, for example, and you pay the local police to ensure that no harm comes to your business, you feel like you're getting something in return. You feel that maybe you've got something over on the competition a couple blocks down the street. So it really binds the population together, and this is a population that's doing things, a critical mass of it is doing things according to a certain way, and it's very difficult not to be corrupt in Russia. You wouldn't get ahead, you wouldn't get very far at least.
Aren't there a number of people, though, who are upset about that? Hey, this is my money, I don't want to give it to you guys.
Absolutely. You know, every time I'm in Moscow, I have to steel myself before stepping into a taxi cab because I know that there is going to be a barrage from the driver about how corrupt the authorities are, how these jerks at the top are plundering the country. So, yeah, I mean, this is a sensitive issue for the Kremlin, and I think this is part of the reason that Putin tries to distract the public from the country's great problems by calling the U.S. Russia's number one foe and invading Crimea and really trying to present himself as a restorer of Russia's greatness on the world stage.
Mm. And in terms of what he's looking at doing right now, is it beyond Crimea? Is he looking for those other areas close to Russia that he would also like to have be a part of Russia?
I wouldn't put him past. I wouldn't put it past him. You know, we know that he invaded Georgia in 2008. It was a very similar situation. Russia already had essentially de facto control of two breakaway regions that it uses to put pressure on the Georgian authorities, who very much want to join the West, want to join the European Union. And I think he's looking to do the same in Ukraine. He's looking to try to cripple the authorities, the new authorities, by essentially controlling a part of the territory. Now, there are other places just like this. The likeliest next one, if there is a next one, would be Moldova, another country that probably would want to join the EU, where there's a breakaway region of mostly pro-Russian local population that Moscow supports. And I think that if Western leaders do not unify, get together, and essentially try to isolate Russia diplomatically, enact sanctions, do what they can to try to make this to make there be costs from invading Crimea, then this may give Putin a green light to do it again.
Mm-hmm. Some have said, analysts of all of this have said, that the Western response to the 2008 action in Georgia was rather lackluster and maybe made Putin think, hey, I can do this again.
Absolutely. And I'm seeing it again, as European countries and the U.S. are debating what to do. There are more negotiations in London today. The argument basically comes down to, do we take action now, or essentially try to negotiate with Putin? And I think that's a false dichotomy. I don't think it's quite I don't think it's quite that simple. Essentially, what Putin is trying to do is to occupy the center of attention on the world stage. As long as there's a crisis going on and we all see Putin's image on CNN, that's exactly where Russia wants to be. We see a crisis in Ukraine. The Russians, I think, at least the Kremlin, sees the country's moments in the sun. Putin will drag on talks saying that he wants to reach a political settlement like we do. And if we take him at his word, I think we're making a big mistake.
We welcome phone calls for our guest, too, also, and here's a good way to get you to respond to see if you agree with this or not. He says only a bold, unified effort to isolate Putin economically and politically would have any chance of proving effective against a regime that welcomes conflict because it stubbornly sees foreign affairs as a zero-sum game. So he says it means isolating the Kremlin politically and economically with all available peaceful means, expelling Russia from the G8, curtailing the purchase of natural gas, freezing the assets of Russian officials and businessmen close to the Kremlin, boycotting Russian vodka, enacting visa restrictions against a large swath of Russian officialdom, and continuing to do so until the last Russian soldier leaves Crimea. What do you think? Do you agree with that? Or do you think, it was interesting, we were talking about some of this yesterday, that Americans have had it with Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria and just don't want to do much of anything. Where do you fall? We welcome your phone calls on this and any questions that you have about who Putin is and why he's doing what he's doing. Gregory Pfeiffer is our guest, former Moscow correspondent for NPR, reported from Russia for a number of years. And he's also the author of the book just released, Russians, the People Behind the Power. Here's our phone number. Join us. We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Russia this hour of the show. Gregory Pfeiffer is our guest, and our phone number, 800-486-8655. Darius in Mineral Point is our first caller. Hi, Darius.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Hello. Yes. Can I ask a question?
Yes, go right ahead, Darius.
Yes, I would like to ask a question, Gregory. About that Russian-Georgian conflict, who began that conflict, and who was firing first shot at this conflict? I was watching Russian news TV at this time, and seems to me that Gregory and everybody else forgot who was firing first shot, and that Russian peacemakers were killed, first of all, in first place. So what Gregory can tell about all of this?
All right, Darius, thank you.
Well, it's a big debate. But, you know, having covered that war, I remember very clearly that, yeah, the first shots were fired by the Georgians, who tried to retake a breakaway Georgian region called South Ossetia. But essentially, the Russians provoked them into doing it. The Russians had massed troops on Russia's southern border. It was backing pro-Moscow militia groups in this Georgian breakaway region. The Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili, made a mistake by falling for this. There was pressure ratcheted up. Firing often of rockets and guns across the de facto border, But this was ramped up. The rocket attacks increased. That whole summer, pressure was being ramped up. But it was really, I think it's, first of all, to believe anything you see on Russian television, it's well known. It's state propaganda. Is very problematic, but also I think it's widely accepted that Russia provoked Georgia into this war and then invaded an independent sovereign country.
Let's go to Matt in Middleton next. Hi, Matt.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I think there's a lot of things that are being misrepresented here to favor a Western viewpoint. If we look at how all of these events actually transpired, it might make things seem a little bit more clear. First, Yanukovych was an elected president. He wasn't a communist leader. He was voted on by the people. We had riots in the capital, in Kiev, by the opposition party, Svoboda. Instead of going to parliament and voting Yanukovych out, they stormed parliament, took it over, then declared him a war criminal. This is after the same people in the party were throwing glass bottles of alcohol that were on fire at the police, who responded probably the same way police in this country would. Yanukovych fears for his life. He goes to Russia, and he says, there has been an illegal takeover of the Ukraine in my country. I am asking for your support to restore the legitimate elected leaders in this government. And if we go down to the lie that we're hearing in the Western media about getting help from the IMF, the monetary help, versus from Russia, the Ukraine is essentially bankrupt. They need money from someplace. Yanukovych initially went to the European Central Bankers, the IMF, and said, give us a loan. We need help. They said, we'll do that, but your people have to agree to pay more in taxes, take less in pay, and essentially have austerity. Putin came in, and it's fine because he has a legitimate interest in that region, and said, we will buy $15 billion of your debt in the form of bonds, which we all know is essentially free money that's probably not going to get paid back. So Yanukovych looks at $3 billion from the European Central Bankers, which are going to hurt my people, or $15 billion from Russia, which is essentially free money. It's not hard to realize why he went with the $15 billion from Russia. Okay, now let's look at Ukraine as far as ethnic divisions. The country was created by Stalin. It was carved out of an area that had very different ethnic peoples in it. The eastern part of Ukraine, where Crimea is mostly Russian, and Russian people that speak Russian have lived there ever since the country was created. In the western part of Ukraine, it's more European, and the people that are in that side of the country are naturally going to favor more of a tie with Europe.
All right, let's get a response. Gregory?
Certainly, Ukraine is a divided country. It's divided almost exactly in half, 50-50, between the essentially pro-Russian East and the pro-Ukrainian West. And this is one of the causes for the intractability of Ukraine's essentially ongoing political crisis. But let's not misrepresent Russia's actions here. Russia wasn't coming in to save Ukraine. Russia would rather see Ukraine erupt in civil war than have it join the West. Essentially, Yanukovych was indeed a democratically elected president, but he was a thug. This guy was a criminal. And this was clear. I covered the election, his election in 2010, and I remember seeing his essentially, and when the exit polls came in, and it was clear that he was going to win, and he gave a victory speech at his campaign headquarters. You could see the type of people that he was surrounded with. These were essentially thugs sitting around in shiny suits and gold chains, sort of sipping champagne, stone-faced, while the parties essentially sort of junior members were junior officials were keeping careful tabs on everybody coming and going. This was a sort of a Soviet sort of mafia style government, and it's plundered the country. There's just no accident that Russia, or rather Ukraine, is on the brink of economic collapse. It's been plundered by the Yanukovych people. Russia has done everything possible to try to undermine Ukraine's success and its westward-leaning, whenever it's displayed a western-leaning bent. But whatever happens, whatever happened in Ukraine, I mean, it's another discussion. We're talking about Russia. Whatever happens in Ukraine during the protests there, what happens subsequently, Russia invaded a European country. It's redrawing European borders in the 21st century by sending in armed men, gunmen, wearing masks and no insignia. This is a schoolyard bully lashing out for Ukrainians having gotten rid of their pro-Moscow president. But it's not just bullying. This is very dangerous because Ukraine is not only fomenting separatism in Crimea. It's basically a set to snatch Crimea away from Russia during after a referendum set for this Sunday. But it has people, it has agents in eastern Ukraine whipping up separatist sentiment, organizing protests, encouraging violence. This is very, very dangerous. Ukraine, I think, is on the brink of civil war. Mm. Hopefully it won't happen. And what Russia is doing is incredibly, incredibly irresponsible.
Thanks very much for the call. You, in your recent piece, say that Russians must be prompted to ask whether their leader has gone around the bend. He'll remain impervious to Western pressure as long as he can portray himself as what you so eloquently described earlier, the restorer of Russian greatness, the authoritarian tough guy who's respected. Are any Russians asking that question right now, and how are they prompted to ask that question?
Well, I mean, very, very few. As I was saying, you know, corruption essentially binds the people to the regime. And although there is a lot of, there are a lot of complaints, as there were under the Soviet Union for many years, a lot of dissatisfaction. There's an understanding that, you know, this is the going system and that people have a stake in the system. You know, one of the questions that we pose and we can't quite understand is, really, how is it that Putin has gotten away with this? How is it that he's remained leader for 14 years? It doesn't look like he's stepping down anytime soon. How is it that Russians, two decades after the collapse of the Soviet Union, continue to
Right.
support authoritarian leaders?
Right.
I think part of the explanation, and this is what I write about in my book, is that Putin came to power resurrecting a centuries-old traditional political culture, and part of it is that the leaders hide what goes on in secret behind the Kremlin's high walls with bluffing and facades. And I think this is part of the reason we don't quite understand Russia, and also that Russians inside Russia don't quite understand, you know, what's going on inside their country. They know something is wrong, but it's difficult to do anything about it. And this has happened for centuries. I think the Russian leaders have done this often by adopting foreign influences that have resulted in what really turned out to be clearly more traditionally Russian. The laws of Catherine the Great, for example, omitted many elements of the Enlightenment thought she claimed they reflected. Soviet communism, another example, would surely have dumbfounded Marx. You know, under Putin, I think one of the clearest example of this was the presidency of his protege, Dmitry Medvedev. He took office when Putin had to step down after his two consecutive term limit ran out. And Western leaders spent essentially the 4 years of his presidency guessing when he would assume the vast powers of his office. Now, of course, that never happened because his reforming Western-looking image served to conceal the real goings-on, which was Putin behind the scene still controlling things. So, you know, again, Russia seems confusing to us, but there's a reason for it. And the leadership may do many things inefficiently. It may sort of besmirch Russia's image on the world stage, but it's very effective at achieving its own aims. The overriding one is staying in power. And in order for us to start dealing with Russia properly, I think we have to understand this. Our mistake is that we take Russian institutions and rhetoric that are meant to deceive outsiders at face value.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Steve in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm wondering if our role in this is being a little overblown. I mean, this is the Ukraine. It's far away. And as your guest said, it's been going on for centuries, these power plays. And I'm wondering if this sort of overblown, over-emotional reaction in this, we really want to rub Putin's nose in this, is not really our role to play. Maybe we should stand back, let those folks there settle it, because we can't really create a new world and an enforcement. We've seen that over and over again in these wars where we set up a government and they turn out to be just as corrupt as the last government. We can't fix this. We need to let those people sort it out. It seems to me that the government in Kiev has been working hard to engage the sort of Russian businessmen in the East. Seems like they're doing a pretty good job of it, but if we get involved, we end up owning the thing. And I don't want to own this. I don't want my kids to be fighting a war there. I don't feel the need to force Putin out of power. I think that's someone else's job.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. And a lot of people feel, as Steve does, polls yesterday showed that Americans don't have much interest in doing much of anything.
That's a very good point. All the points are excellent. Look, I don't think that we should be doing anything to get into a war at all, and I don't think we should be doing anything actually to get rid of Putin. That's not the issue here. The issue is what we should be doing to defend our interests and our values and those of our allies in Europe. This is very much of interest to countries like Poland, which is a neighbor of Ukraine, which was part of the Soviet bloc, dominated by the Soviet Union for 40 years after World War II. Poland is an ally of ours. And I think it's concerned what will happen if Putin gets away with this and feels that he can go on and do more. This issue concerns us very much because of other issues of Iran and Syria. Putin has done what he can to try to stymie international action over Syria, where tens and tens and tens of thousands of innocent people are dying. He has tried to stymie international action over Iran and a whole host of other issues. So it certainly does concern us. Now, again, I don't think we should be going, we shouldn't be going to war, clearly, but we should be using diplomatic efforts, economic efforts, to try to stand up for our efforts, to try to further our values, and make it clear that there will be costs if Putin gets away with this. Mm-hmm. I think one of the one of our aims should be trying to convince the Russian people that what he's doing is bad for Russia in the long run.
When you talk about defending our interests and our values, do we have interest in Ukraine other than what our values are?
Not many. Ukraine and Russia is far more important to Europe, to our European allies. For the U.S., this is really not an issue of economics. But I think Ukraine could be a moment for President Obama, whose foreign policy has been much maligned recently, I think with some justification, to really try to right that by taking the lead on Ukraine. I think the American policy during his first term, he enacted a so-called Russia reset, try to engage Russia on issues of mutual interest. Was a very good one. He tried to rescue ties that were very low at the end of the Bush administration. But Putin has been bent on basically being antagonistic, trying to stoke a new form of Cold War. And at every effort, as we've seen, taking in Edward Snowden, for example, over Syria, he's tried to stymie the U.S. and other Western countries. And I think if the U.S. now acts as a leader in trying to unify Western governments to act over Ukraine, taking the measures that you outlined earlier, I think that would go far in toward essentially resurrecting at least the image of Obama's foreign policy.
And what about, Gregory, those European leaders? Are they all in with this? Are they divided?
Well, as I was saying, they are divided. There are countries that depend very heavily on Russia for energy, for natural gas. One of them is Germany, which is essentially the European political and economic leader. Germany depends on Russia for 40% of its natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
Very important for the industrial, for the economy, for the industrial machine there. And so they're wary of, essentially of what they think is provoking Putin by taking unnecessary action. But as I was saying before, I think that's essentially a false dichotomy. I don't think it's a, you know, I think Putin wants negotiations to go on for as long as possible and to try to occupy the global limelight. So I don't think there's much of an alternative to taking some kind of strong measures.
Mm-hmm. So it's also in the purview of the President of the United States or others to make sure that Germany goes along with this in all the strong ways that you outlined in your piece?
I think so. I mean, I think we should be making that case. I think we've enacted some visa bans, for example, on some Russian officials, but I think we should be doing more. Now, I don't think we should be pressuring these countries, but I think at least rhetorically we should be taking the leadership on this one.
More phone calls in a moment and emails. We're talking about Russia, Putin, why he's doing what he's doing, and our response to what he's doing. Gregory Pfeiffer is our guest, former Moscow correspondent for NPR. He reported from Russia for a number of years. His new book is Russians, The People Behind the Power. He's also the author of The Great Gamble, A History of the Soviet War in Afghanistan, and co-author of Spy Handler. And we're welcoming phone calls for him. Here's how you reach us. A couple lines are open at 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. You can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. An email that has come in, Gregory Dory emails, I'm very much opposed to the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. However, I wonder if the U.S. has lost a lot of moral authority on the topic of invasions after having invaded both Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, I believe certainly it does. I think it's very difficult. We saw John Kerry, the Secretary of State, recently criticize Russia for invading a country on false pretenses, which was correct. But we also recently invaded a country on false pretenses. I think our authority has very much been eroded. But, of course, that's a topic of another conversation.
Joanne in Jacksonport. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I just really like what our guest said about invading other countries, and I think that shouldn't even be mentioned in our conversation. But it does seem to me that NATO exists for a reason, and I don't think that we're always real enthusiastic team players, and I really wish that we would, what we've done with passports, et cetera, so far is all right. But I think we should just work in concert with NATO and not try to do so much by ourselves. They have a great deal in store with all of what's going on.
Mm, Gregory.
Sure, I agree. I think that the more international organizations such as NATO, such as the EU, can act, the better. But in many cases, the U.S. Is the driving force behind NATO, and I think, again, I think there is a lot of will in Europe to try to do something about Ukraine, make sure that at the very least this doesn't happen in another country. But, you know, there are 28 different countries inside the EU, and they're very difficult to unite them, and that's why I think that, again, as I said before, I think the U.S. should take the leadership on this.
Thanks, Joanne, for the call. Fred is next in Milwaukee. Hello, Fred.
Hi, how are you, Kathleen? It's Fred Kessler.
Hi, Fred. Fine, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Kathleen, I think that we are basically backing ourselves into a terrible corner by even intervening to the degree that we are. First, a coup took place, and a democratically elected leader was ousted. That really troubles me when we end up doing that. I appreciate there's corruption, but there was corruption under the previous administration in the Ukraine, too. The previous president went to jail. We are seeing ourselves sort of pitting ourselves in a situation where we don't have any really historical interest. Since Catherine the Great in, I think, 1648, the Ukraine was part of Russia. It was only free during a brief period after World War One, and then after the overthrow of Gorbachev. I think that when you look at Crimea and you look at the portion of the eastern part of the Ukraine, that's really been historically even part of Russia and was never even part of the Ukraine. I'm looking at this and I'm saying, what's the end game for the U.S.? What's our percentage in it? We're only raising, in my opinion, a degree of temperature that's going to result in probably nothing occurring. We're going to end up eventually acquiescing to the Russia taking the Crimea and probably even taking part of the rest of the Ukraine. And, you know, I just think we're stoking up a Cold War, which is unnecessary at this point. And I think we're sort of fooling around because we're pissed at Putin because of his actions in granting shelter to Snowden.
Gregory.
Well, look, you know, very good points, but let's be clear about who's stoking the Cold War here. We have bent over backwards not to criticize Vladimir Putin, to let him get away with very, very many things on many issues. Invading Crimea was justified as an action to protect Russian speakers in Ukraine who were threatened by a completely false threat cooked up by Russian propaganda of Ukrainian fascists who had apparently taken over the government. Now, that's not to say that extremist right-wing groups weren't a part of the protests in Ukraine. They were, but it was a small minority. Ukraine is not in the hands of fascists. Now, this justification of protecting Russian speakers in a neighboring sovereign country was exactly the same justification that Hitler used to annex the Sudetenland from Czechoslovakia and Austria before World War II. So, you know, I think that's something to think about. Another thing is about Viktor Yanukovych, the former pro-Moscow president who was just ousted. This wasn't some guy who just presided over a little bit of corruption. This was a thug who stole billions and billions of dollars. He arrested his political opponents. He arrested his rival, his biggest rival, Yulia Tymoshenko, who was freed only after Yanukovych fled. He arrested other people. Critics of the government were beaten. There were disappearances. There was the free press was censored. This was not some kind of just sort of you know bad leader you know sort of typical bad leadership. This person was rapidly rolling back the democratic gains of Ukraine's Orange Revolution in 2004. Now, about the sort of historical legacy of Ukraine belonging to Russia, it was for a long time. It was a part of the Russian Empire for centuries. At least part of Ukraine was, and of course, all of what's Ukraine today was part of the Soviet Union until recently. But I mean, would you also argue that the colonists in what was to be the United States shouldn't have staged a rebellion against British rule because those colonies belong to Britain?
Fred, you want to respond quickly?
I think that's certainly a very ludicrous article. I mean, you know, we certainly settled in you know in Massachusetts in the 1640s, and we had a revolution. But I don't think ours was based on a right-wing philosophy like what I think is going on over there.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but this right-wing philosophy
was a democratically elected system, and it may have been flawed.
Well, Hitler was elected as well. I mean, you know, if you want to make those kinds of parallels, you know, there's a lot of Russian propaganda about fascists taking over control of Ukraine, and it is simply not true. This is Russian propaganda.
Thank you very much, Fred, for your call. Well, what kind of faith do you have in the new leadership, at least temporary new leadership, who will be meeting with President Obama tomorrow at the White House?
Well, I think that the leaders have a tremendous lot on their plate. If they, you know, if they manage to get Ukraine out of its current predicament, it would be surprising. It faces economic crisis. It's facing separatism in eastern Ukraine. You know, I think they've just taken office, and so far they have managed to keep as much stability as I think they possibly could. But it's a very, very tall order, and of course you've got Russia trying to whip up separatism, you know, where it can in Ukraine. So I fear for the country. I fear for the worst. Mm. And I think that even if the worst can be avoided, what's happening now, these you know, these tensions, you know, nationalist hatreds between, you know, Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers that Russia is doing everything it can to whip up, the legacy is going to go on for decades at least.
Steele in Appleton, hi. Hello? Not there. Let's go to an email. Joe in Prairie du Chien asks, how much does the atmosphere of the U.S. Congress affect Putin's calculations? Also, how much coverage do U.S. politics get in Russian media?
It's a good question. You know, I think that not much. I mean, that's the answer. I think that essentially Putin has created a myth that the U.S. is Russia's number one enemy, and I think there's a reason for that. If you look at what's going on in the country, in a lot of ways it's in crisis. Moscow may be very wealthy thanks to the income from Russia's vast energy resources. There are, you know, luxury cars clogging traffic jams across the city. There are new restaurants and nightclubs, very fancy ones, opening up all the time. But if you drive just 20-30 miles outside of Moscow, the countryside is literally dying. You know, I've been to many villages where, you know, there used to be many people living there, and now there are, you know, one or two elderly people living along, you know, a muddy track with, in a very apocalyptic scenes, you know, trees going through houses, windows broken, you know, a total collapse of society. You know, alcoholism is rampant in Russia. A fifth of Russian males die from alcohol-related causes. AIDS, tuberculosis, poverty is rampant. So in many ways, the country is headed toward crisis. And I think that a lot of what Putin is doing, both in foreign policy, trying to confront the West, but also ramping up his authoritarianism at home, is to try to sort of shore up his popularity among a core group of conservative voters. For example, cracking down against gays, passing so-called anti-gay laws, has generated a lot of terrible press for Russia and the West. But look, two-thirds of Russians believe that homosexuality is immoral. So what he's doing makes sense for him at home, and I think that a lot of what is going on can be explained that way.
Mm. How old is he? How old is Putin?
That's a good question. I think he's in his mid-60s. I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember. Yeah.
It must be true that he's taking Botox then, huh?
Well, I mean, if you look at his face, he's really become a kind of a caricature of an aging dictator to us, and I think his face has sort of changed from, you know, kind of an impassive former KGB officer to, yeah, what's really this sort of self-righteous aging dictator type.
Right. One more phone call. James in Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi. I have three friends who live in Ukraine. One in Nikolayev, one in Lugansk, which is in eastern Ukraine, and one actually in Crimea in the exotic place of Kerch, which is on the Sea of Azov. And the last time I spoke with her, she said that there are some strange large boats swimming up and down her coastline, and she's fearful. And my friend in Lugansk, in the eastern Ukraine, she's fearful. And my friend in Nikolayev had an air flight ticket for here out of Odessa. She can't come here now.
Mm. Let's get we're almost out of time. Gregory?
I think it reflects that the country really is on edge and is on sort of the precipice of crisis, and that's why I think it's important that we take resolute, very sane but clear actions to show that Putin's actions in Ukraine will have consequences for Russia. And I think that the main goal should be to convince, to try to show Russians that what he's doing is not in Russia's interest at the end of the day.
Yeah. Thank you so much, James, for the call. Gregory, thank you for all of your knowledge and being with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
Gregory Pfeiffer, he is the former Moscow correspondent for NPR. He has a new book, Russians, The People Behind the Power, just published, just released this month. And he wrote a piece that caught our attention that you can find in globalpost.com. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour and to Cynthia Schuster for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for your interest and also for your phone calls.